What's up, family? You are tuned into Law and Disorder, a podcast where we expose the cracks in our system, agitate for resistance, and collectively build a new world in which all of us can thrive. From KPFA Radio and the Pacifica Network, I'm your host, Kat Brooks.
It's been 689 days since October 7th, 2023. In today's casualties update, there have been 62,700 Palestinians murdered by Israel since October 7th. This includes over 200 journalists and 300 people murdered by starvation, including 117 children. A statement from the Palestinian Ministry of Health said 58 people were murdered and 308 others injured in the past 24 hours, bringing the total number of injuries to 158,259 people. We know from research similar to that which was done in The Lancet that the death toll is closer to over 80,000, and even that is likely an undercount. Here on Law and Disorder, we've spent the majority of the Mondays of the last almost 2 years bringing you Palestine Post, where we push back on the Israeli and U.S. mainstream media campaign of disinformation in their attempts to justify a genocide. We began today's Palestine Post with headlines analysis with Curry Peterson Smith, Michael Ratner Middle East Fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies, where he researches U.S. Empire, borders, and migration. Good morning, Curry.
Good morning, Kat.
It's been too long, my friend. I'm glad to have you back, though.
Grateful to be here.
Of course, not happy that we're still talking about this genocide.
Right.
We're also joined by my friend Zara Ballou, the Executive Director of the Bay Area Office of the Council on American Islamic Relations, or CARE. Good morning, Zara.
Good morning, Kat.
I mean, Curry knows that a lot of times I have to pause and just sit in our humanity for a second. You both sound exhausted. Zara, how was your heart and soul this morning?
Heavy. Mm. Heavy coming to you knowing that several journalists were killed in Gaza again this morning.
Yeah. Curry.
I think disbelief is the word that comes to mind. I was listening to the news this morning and I said out loud, I can't believe this. Feel very grateful to have what I have. And I can't believe that those of us who have some food in the fridge and, you know, a roof over our heads share the same planet, you know, with people who are, for whom that's being stolen every day.
Yeah. Thank you for sitting in the humanity for a second. It gets easy for organizers, activists, myself as a journalist, right? We just grind away. But to your point, Zara, the big headline this morning is the bombing of Nasser Hospital again, murdering 20 people, including five of my colleagues, journalists. The first thing I want to get from y'all is your reaction. And Zara, I'm going to start with you, your reaction. And then second, if you could help us get an understanding of what of the hospitals left to bomb, because my understanding is that the infrastructure of Nasser Hospital has been completely devastated at this point, the result of multiple bombings over the last 2 years, which not for nothing, but apparently for nothing, is violation of international law. Zara?
Sure. So this morning we woke up to news that Nasser Hospital had been bombed again. But what's sitting with me is that it was a double tap bombing. And so for those who aren't familiar with that strategy, there is a first attack and then the government, the military waits for rescue workers to come in, which at this point is other civilians, and then bombs again. And so I first learned of that tactic and what it was when the United States was doing it. Mm-hmm. And so that's where I'm sitting right now, is for as many times as we have called this a U.S.-funded genocide or called the United States a co-conspirator in the genocide, to think that a tactic I first learned of decades ago in my early days as an anti-war organizer is the same tactic Israel is engaging in on live stream with video evidence brings it full circle. They are using our weapons, they are using our tactics, and they are doing so far more unapologetically than even our own very vile and violent government has. where are the people of Gaza supposed to go? And what else should we know or deduce from the reality that the Israeli occupation forces continue to kill the storytellers?
Sorry, as you were, first of all, I'm sort of embarrassed. I didn't know what a double tap bombing was. But also, like, as we've been doing this for the last 2 years, right? Like, I say a lot that APTP, Anti-Police Terror Project, has been in solidarity with our Palestinian comrades since our inception, 18 years ago. But I couldn't remember, like, what the first sort of linkage was. And as you were talking, it was exactly that. It was the shared information, the shared technology, the shared training that bound the struggle for Black liberation to the struggle for Palestinian liberation. That's not necessarily a question or a comment or a question or something to tug on. I just was remembering an early, early panels right before we ever got here and protests and conversations about the very thing you just said. Curry.
Yeah. First of all, what a blessing to be in conversation with the two of you. And I am so grateful for Zara bringing in that very recent, but very much not forgotten, but erased history, you know, of U.S. violence under the so-called war on terror, which I want to say a bit more about. But first, just to go back to your question, Kat, which is really important about what is left to attack when it comes to these medical facilities. And you're right, like every single medical facility, as far as I understand, in Gaza has been attacked one way or another. And very obviously, they're systematically attacking journalists too. Obviously, they just assassinated a high profile journalist for Al Jazeera. Openly, brazenly, they said, yeah, we targeted him. We followed him and stalked him and targeted him and killed him. And this latest horrific bombing was also part of that kind of campaign. So it's very straightforward that Israel systematically attacking medical facilities and personnel and patients, you know, is very straightforwardly systematically attacking journalists, has systematically destroyed, you know, every single campus of higher learning in Gaza. And as you point out, Kat, that hospital, despite its having been attacked before, was still operational. And so I do want to not for a minute kind of conceding the horror of this, acknowledge that this is also a story of Palestinian resilience, that, yeah, the fact is that these facilities are attacked and yet personnel show up day after day, you know, and do what they can. If I could just say a word about building on both what Zara said about double tap and what you said, Kat, about, you know, the brilliant work of the Anti-Police Terror Project and the connections between the anti-Black, anti-Brown, anti-immigrant, et cetera, policing in this country and Israeli apartheid. I think that what that's pointing to is why these states, the U.S. and Israel and the European states and so on, why they're doing all this and why they're tolerating it. Because I think so many, I mean, at this point, the majority of people in this country say, yeah, the U.S. should stop sending weapons to Israel. And certainly majorities in countries around the world are saying the same thing. And there's this question of why are these governments allowing this to happen? And I think what y'all are pointing to is that the extent of collaboration on the mutual goals of Israel and the United States is so deep that the U.S. says, we're going to pilot this tactic called the double tap. And Israel says, thank you, we'll borrow that, you know? And then Israel says, we're going to, in a very public, spectacular way, build walls to wall off, you know, the borders that we're claiming. And the U.S. says, thank you. Yeah, we already have some walls, but we're going to do it more openly, the way y'all are doing it. And a lot of countries right now that are being called on to impose arms embargoes, it's not just that they're selling weapons to Israel, they're planning on buying weapons from Israel. That is how this all keeps on going. And so I just wanted to underscore that, because it reveals why these governments are so invested despite the fact that we're watching this genocide happen and everybody's clear on what's happening, you know, this is about maintaining things the way they are, and the extent of their sharing is so deep, they want to maintain it.
I've been asked a lot lately to talk about the ways in which, you know, because of what's happening here, I've been asked a lot to talk about, like, the ways in which artists are some of the first folks, you know, the truth tellers, journalists, some of the first folks to be murdered when, you know, dictators come to power, as we're watching here in the United States, or genocide continues, as we've been watching in Israel. And one of the things I've been, I'm totally going off script here, but Curry, you just brought this to mind. One of the things I've been comparing it to is history, right? Because we can really better understand where we are and where we're going if we have the discipline to look at our history. And so one of the things I've been looking particularly with artists is Nazi Germany and the way in which they targeted artists in particular, right? Like, first degraded, then criminalized, then replaced, then murdered. And so I've also been, you're putting in that context of the larger strategy and the stair-stepping to the Holocaust that happened in Nazi Germany. And I've been really hesitant to do this as directly as I'm about to do this, but I cannot help but also align the way the rest of the world watched that happen, right? Just watched. Watched the massacres happen, watched the genocide, I mean, just watched to what is happening today. It's a similar playbook with 21st century weapons, and world powers are just watching it happen, throwing up their hands and going, "Oh well, those people don't matter," or we have financial investments that are more important than 117 babies that have now starved to death.
Well, that's important that you bring up that history, Kat, because there is an American mythology. I mean, I'm less familiar with how, you know, the history of the Holocaust and the bystanderism, you know, and the enabling of it, not just standing by, but actually enabling it. I don't know how that's narrated elsewhere in the world, but in the U.S., there is this kind of narrative of like, oh, you know, we just didn't know, you know, and it's usually narrated through the form of U.S. soldiers arriving in concentration camps and, of course, being horrified and shocked, you know, when they find Jewish folks starving or having been murdered. But the truth is the U.S. did know. I mean, you know, boatloads of Jewish folks sought refuge in this country. They were turned away, you know, by an anti-Semitic Roosevelt administration. And so, you know, I do hope that as we are witnessing and resisting this genocide, that more and more folks are doing what you're talking about, Kat, what you're doing, which is looking back on history. And I hope a lot of Americans question the histories that we've inherited that say that the U.S. has been on the right side, because what they're doing now is what they did then, except much worse in so many ways, because it's American bombs, you know, it's American cover for the starvation and the murder of journalists and so on. So just appreciating that, Kat.
Zara, is there anything you want to add there?
I'm agreeing with everything you're saying, but also thinking how much to the mythology, like that word resonates, because a conversation we've been having among friends and colleagues is how deeply programmed we are around Israel being the only democratic state, and what is it, a land for people, something without a land, right? Like all of that stuff, and what it gives both Zionists permission to do, and what it gives us permission to overlook. Like, think about just, they're having dance parties next to concentration camps, and nobody talks about how that is not okay. That's where I get stuck, is like, what is it about how deeply Islamophobic and anti-Arab and anti-Palestinian we are as a country, and how we put everyone in Israel in a pedestal? There was a story a couple of weeks ago about an Israeli caught up in a like sex trafficking ring in Las Vegas, where the federal government intervened to allow him to be sent back to Israel, all the while barring amputated children from Gaza from coming to the United States. Like, is that about capital or is that about something deeper? We see those kids with only one leg as dangerous, but we see that Israeli child sex trafficker as okay and meriting due process somewhere else, convenient for him.
You mentioned the children that the amputees not able to come in the country. So I'll just take this moment to say Laura Loomer is evil and trash. Israel, Zara, has said and is in the process of what they refer to, this is not my words, right, as seizing Gaza City. It would be laughable if it wasn't so painful, the use of that language. I mean, as I was reading that, I'm like, I don't understand how this is different than what has been happening. But what do I, maybe I'm wrong. This also, right, includes the mandatory evacuation of over 1 million Palestinians from the north to the south, which experts are saying is impossible. And I can't help but feeling this is a deja vu headline that I was saying in November of 2023. Your response, Sarah.
You're right. It feels like, well, so a distinction is the way I understand it, when Israel says it will seize a city, it will push the Palestinians out yet again. It will establish a permanent ground presence. It won't just be fighting from the air, it will be fighting from the ground, which, let it be known, I pray they suffer such significant loss, and they will. But the point is that the Palestinians will too. And what we worry about when they claim to seize these cities is that they're not giving them back, right? And so Palestinians are being crowded into an ever shrinking portion of Gaza, with no access to food, water, medical care, often separated from their families in the displacement process as well. And so, will it be a disaster? Yes. Have they been trying to do it for so long? Yes. And does it confirm what so many of us, yourself included, have been saying, is that this is not just about disempowering or removing Hamas? This is about taking the land and forcing the people out by death or destruction.
Sorry.
Yeah, I mean, of course I agree. And what I just wanted to add or underline, Kat, what you're saying when you said, I feel like I've heard this before, in 2023. I mean, that's because you have. And what's, I mean, part of what the people prosecuting this genocide want, the Israelis and the Americans want, is for us to not have an attention span that like goes back 22 months. Do you know what I mean? And so they're like, there's no starvation in Gaza, and oh, well, apparently there's some food problem, but we don't. This is an accident. And we'll get to the bottom of this and whatever. And it's like, no. On October 9th, 2023, Yoav Gallant, the Minister of Defense, said, no food, no water, no fuel. This is a complete siege. That's what he said. This was the plan, right? So when you're talking about remembering, I think I've heard before them saying that they wanted to seize Gaza City. That's because this has been the plan that on the Israeli end, they've been talking about openly since literally the day after October 7th, And again, they are also hoping that we're not literally just following the Israeli news, because if you do, Bezalel Smotrich, he's a minister in the government, is saying the plan is to take all of Gaza. It will be Jewish. We want to take the whole strip. That's what government ministers are saying. So, yeah, it's absolutely, it's affirming what you heard, Kat. It's affirming what Zara just said. And we're not inventing that, that the Israelis are telling us what they're doing. You know, it's not about all this, it's about the hostages. They're very straightforward that it's about the land and taking control of it.
Thanks for that, Karine. Yeah, it was the seize of Gaza City, but it was also like the mandatory evacuation of 1 million Palestinians
right
from one end of the strip to the other end of the strip, which even back then was impossible and dangerous, and there were so many casualties. And I'm just like, Zara, question for you. I've interviewed a bunch of folks clearly over the last 2 years, and almost all of them. You know, folks have been in this work for a long time, have said that they saw this coming, this level of violence, this level of carnage. In fact, Pulitzer Prize journalist Chris Hedges asserts that there's nowhere else it could have gone. Do you agree, and did you see this coming?
I agree. Did I see it coming in this way? No, but maybe that's my own last shred of optimism. And I saw something the other day. Somebody said, and I can't remember who I'm supposed to attribute this to, but they said the Nakba didn't happen in 1948. It began in 1948. Mm-hmm. In other words, it's been ongoing. The state of Israel relies on the dehumanization of Palestinians to exist. It thrives on the story we've all been told about Palestinians being dangerous and Arabs wanting to kill them. And it grows on land theft, murder, mayhem, Zionist supremacy. And so it does, it shouldn't surprise us that when Palestinians rose out of their cage, out of the world's largest open-air prison, that Israel took permission to exact a death toll live-streamed in ways more horrific than any of us have ever witnessed.
Harry, have I ever asked you that?
I don't recall. I don't think so, but it's a great question, and I feel complicated, to be honest, about the answer, because on one hand, yeah, like it's everything Zara is saying, like taking complete control of the land is the logical conclusion of all colonization, you know, including Zionist colonization. Like that's what they want. And so this is a, you know, the kind of violence that we're witnessing is a logical conclusion of the entire Zionist settler project. What I feel complicated about is that it's not the only conclusion. I don't want to concede that this was inevitable. Mm. And that there's, that not only that there's nothing that we could have done, but that there's something, I mean, one of the things that you and I have talked about, Kat, is like I take kind of an opposite, like when I look at, you know, what happened in October 7, 2023, I take kind of an opposite conclusion that this kind of violence was inevitable, because for me, it's more like we're seeing the fundamental limits of Zionism. Like, Gaza was besieged for 17 years. I mean, they locked people in for 17 years. They can, you know, the kind of, you know, controlling the caloric intake, which is an Israeli conversation that they're having now. They're able to starve Gaza now because they've had lots of practice. They've honed this tactic over 17 years. You know what I mean? And they bombed. I mean, you know, they pulled out all the Jewish Israelis so they could bomb Gaza freely, which they did repeatedly, and after all that violence, folks are still there, you know what I mean? And still trying to break out of the cage. And that's why I'm like, oh, it's not a matter of if Israeli colonization ends, it's when it ends and how it ends, you know? So I do think that this kind of violence is built into the whole Israeli project, but I also think that there's a number of variables and contradictions that are also built into that project, including the fact that they depend on a country like the United States to supply everything, you know, the weapons, the political cover, like everything, the money. There's a lot of weaknesses too that I also want us to pay attention to.
I'm sort of waiting for the day that Trump decides that he's mad at Netanyahu, because I you know how he, I mean, he, you know, he flips back and forth, and and that may be the only way. That's right. If he decides that Netanyahu is bad, very bad. Sorry.
Like the Elon Musk fallout. I could be okay with that.
Zara, the tagline of this show is expose, agitate, and build us. So I wanna give you what I think, I'm looking at the time, maybe our final words. What is the work of CARE in this moment?
Our work has been to protect and empower people who are speaking out against the genocide. To ensure that if you have questions about how to do this in your workplace, or at school, especially at school, that we will protect you. And I should note, by the way, that we've, for example, labeled Stanford a hostile campus. Mm-hmm. We will designate UC Berkeley a hostile campus this week also. And so we want to protect the students and faculty at universities, at high schools and middle schools that are challenging the complicity and the investment in the genocide, or who, you know, want to do something as simple as wear a watermelon t-shirt to school. We've received complaints from families where Zionists are saying that watermelon t-shirt makes me uncomfortable. And I'll tell you, like, our repeated advice to the family is, if the principal dares to tell you you can't wear it, give them our phone number. Otherwise, wash the t-shirt and wear it again tomorrow, and then And then it's also been to ensure that our legislators know that we're paying attention and that they have a responsibility to speak out against the genocide and to protect our ability to do that. And to those ends, I'll lift up three really quick things. We've been mobilizing against Assembly Bill 715, which would curb the ability of educators to critically teach ethnic studies, or to teach ethnic studies with any semblance of critical thinking. In other words, pro-Israel legislators like Senator Wiener, Assemblymember Gabriel, and others are attempting to limit how teachers and students can talk about Palestine by restricting ethnic studies. So we're opposing Assembly Bill 715. There's also a really great op-ed in the Sacramento Bee this week that calls on the legislature to put forward a resolution condemning the genocide in Gaza. And then the last piece is to make sure that our members of Congress, right, Congresswoman Latifah Simon and Congressman Ro Khanna have been champions on this, but there are others like Congressman Eric Swalwell and Congressman Jimmy Panetta, who have been on the wrong side of it. And so really pushing our elected officials to say, no, the polls tell you that your constituents want an end to this genocide, and you need to represent us and not AIPAC, and not JCRC, and not any other pro-Israel groups when you're in D.C. Represent your constituents. Keep the money in the United States. If anything, Marjorie Taylor Greene has been the most confusing person in all of this, because all of a sudden her MAGA is making her anti-Israel. And that works. Mm-hmm. Keep the money in the United States. But that's the last prong of it. Protect individual rights. Push our legislators at a state level, and then ensure that our federal elected officials are not sending billions of dollars in military aid to Israel.
With no due respect, it shouldn't take polls from your constituents to impact your decision to stop supporting genocide. But, you know, I mean.
And I'm embarrassed that Marjorie Taylor Greene sounds more humanitarian than Eric Swalwell, Jimmy Panetta, Kevin Mullen, Nancy Pelosi. Like, this is embarrassing for anyone who claims to be a Democrat. And any California resident who votes in these districts.
All right, y'all, I got to leave it there. I've got some parents on the line that are going to talk to us about the Solidarity Fast for Gaza. So I want to give them as much time as I can. And as you know, time is short. Thank you both so much for joining me this morning.
Thank you.
Thank you, Kat. Thank you, Zara.
You've been listening to Law and Disorder, a podcast where we expose the cracks in our system, agitate for resistance, and collectively build a new world in which all of us can thrive. That's it for this episode, family. You can find more information about topics and guests in this episode's show notes. Law and Disorder is produced at KPFA. That's listener-supported radio on the Pacifica Network. The show is produced by Jesse Strauss and hosted by me, Kat Brooks. Our theme music was composed by Steve Raskin of Fort Knox 5. If you like what you heard, please follow us on social media at Law and Dis, that's D-I-S, and subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts. Feel free to holler at us about something you heard or send us a show idea at lawanddisorder@kpfa.org. You can also find our content live at 8 a.m. weekdays on KPFA. That's 94.1 FM in the Bay Area. Our show and all of KPFA's programs are funded exclusively by you, the listener. And if you're in a position to support us, please donate today at kpfa.org. Take care of yourself and take care of each other. We all we got, fam.